Welcome to In the Stiffs. Thank you very much to our sponsors for Series 2, Budgeon Motors. Been established for 40 years. Best car dealership in Shropshire.
Debatable.
Well, we've all had cars from there. Gav, you've been to Budgeon?
Yeah, a few times now.
Dave, two big time. The only one's Teslas, doesn't he?
But to be fair, though, they do Teslas. Do any car. You want a car, they'll get you a car.
I just spoke to them. They are fast, to be fair.
Even Dave's backed him, you know, the good one. When Dave's on side with him,
I've been up at 20%.
Have we sorted out the discount? Come down to Budgeon, mentioning the Stiffs, and what we'll have to sort out. Was that discount?
Yeah, about 90%.
Yeah,
it?
We'll
just don't tell
that.
The MD.
That'll have to be sorted out at the showroom.
Yeah, to be confirmed, that one.
You know, I mean, you can get it wrong once, but twice, three times.
This is my highlight question, Gaffer. What was in your head?
Yes, it wasn't a case of them wanting me, it was a case of me wanting to go there. I just loved the place.
What age did you actually relocate then down to?
I left home when I was 15. My mum and dad took me to Durham Station, gave me £1.10 and said, go away. My first contract with Aston Villa was £14 a week. 77, I scored 2 in the final, 3 in the semi-final.
No.
I got hammered in the dressing room at half-time. He absolutely destroyed me. But then I just laughed it off and went out and scored a hat-trick in the second half and got on with it sort of things. And Cruyff came off injured after 66 minutes and the entire crowd clapped him off the pitch. The Villa fans and everything. But I also played against Beckenbauer, if you want another one.
Keep coming.
Got a lot of good players who retired very early, you know. Went into the club shop and asked if there was a job for me. And I worked in the club shop for 3 months. It was the infamous time of the Barty brothers were owned the club. He's in London. He's having a nose job at 8 o'clock in the morning. He won't play on Saturday. Put the phone down. Gaffer, if we score, we've won. Because nobody's scoring past me today. What was I called? Judas, that was it. Kept thinking to myself, I'd enjoy it more lower down again. But it wasn't the case, you know. And then I ended up the manager of the national team for
Wouldn't have a scrap with him, would you?
Oh, my word. Time to. Do you know Gareth Southgate would be the manager of England? I'm going, no. He actually has said on a club official video that he was looking forward one day to perhaps playing for Barcelona in the Italian league.
I'm not angry, just disappointed.
That was the worst, though. That was the worst.
Absolutely. Because, to say, before I came, this is probably the most nervous I've ever been in my life, Sam, thinking of you two boys.
Welcome to another episode of In the Stiffs podcast. We've got a special guest today. We are doing this podcast from Budgeon Motors Showroom. Very fancy venue, lads, isn't it?
Beautiful.
Not that your Gavin's outhouse isn't special, but this is something we've gone
outhouse,
up a notch.
That's old fashioned, but yeah.
Shed.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on to our guest. Right, this guest was born in Newcastle, although I have seen he was born in Durham, but we'll clarify that in a minute. Played for Aston Villa 302 times, scored 80 goals, won an England cap, then became a manager, starting at Wolves and managing Darlington, Leicester, Villa, Stoke, West Brom, Hull, Tranmere, Wrexham, Gainsborough and Jersey. As a player, you won the League Cup twice, scored 2 in a final. You're looking amazed if loads of this is wrong, Gaffer. Wait a minute. As a manager, won the Conference, Fourth Division, League Cup, promotion at the Premier League, various Manager of the Month award, including Premier League Manager of the Month in January 1995, and was the last Villa manager to win a major trophy. We've got Brian Little. How much of that was true, Gaffer?
That's not bad, Sam.
Any of it
that's
good?
Pretty good.
Yeah. My research has gone up a notch from Series 1 there, hasn't it?
Fairly accurate, yeah. No probs. It was good. Yeah, that's
so you're happy with all that information?
I'm happy,
that was all spot
that's
on.
Not bad.
And how are you, Gaffer? Obviously, just got out of the car.
Can we just clarify why we've called him Gaffer? Because because obviously, Gavin, you played for him at Gainsborough, didn't you?
Yeah.
And Gaffer, you actually signed me 3 times, didn't you, for Tranmere?
Not many.
Wrexham and Northampton.
Strange.
Yeah. Like, you know, I mean, you can get it wrong once, but twice, three
this is,
times.
This is my highlight question, Gaffer. What was in your head?
Listen, Sam, he was a good lad. And I liked Sam around. He was good at where he played well for me, played different positions for me. And I was a bit like that as a, you know, when you look at the era I managed in, there was a big space for utility players, people who could play different roles. We didn't have massive squads and things like that then.
Utility? Where else did he play?
The gaffer used me as left wing or sub.
Gaffer, it sounds like you've described the mascot there.
Yeah. And that as well.
Oh, no, you
and entertainment manager.
I liked him in midfield more than anything else. I mean, I really did. He played midfield a lot for me, running. And I used to like...
Hooking things on.
Again, I was brought up with a Ron Saunders plan when I became a football manager. And there was always a midfield player who could run. And Sam could run. always, you know. So
Gaffer, if I'd been Welsh, I'd have had 125 caps if I was Welsh. Yeah. Flipping heck.
Yeah. But yeah, that's why we call him Gaffer, because obviously we played, and it's a respectful term, isn't it? In something, I don't think I could ever call you anything else, Gaffer. There, yeah. To be honest. Yeah, weird.
So let's go back to the start. So you're a boy from the northeast, and you end up at Aston Villa. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, again, I for a lot of people today, they'll be going, well, it happens all the time. But back in 1970s, it was just unheard of, really. You know, I mean, there was no academies, no nothing like that at all. Basically, I'd been asked for a trial at Port Vale, believe it or not. That was the first club I ever went to.
So Newcastle does not interest when you're
a kid? No, there wasn't, because Port Vale had a scout. So Stanley Matthews was the manager. He was Stanley Matthews then. He wasn't knighted at that time. So I was invited to go down to Port Vale at the age of sort of 12 year old.
What level were they at the time, Gaffer?
They were in the lower divisions. Right. So Stanley Matthews had this plan about trying to create young players at his club to take it on in the future. He was never given the opportunity after time, but I was invited down there. I really enjoyed it. I did well. And then it began to spread around a bit. So I was invited to a couple of other clubs. Then all my family from the northeast started speaking to, especially a fella called Malcolm Musgrove, who was related to my side of the family. Malcolm played for West Ham, but he was at that time the assistant manager at Aston Villa. So on the back of me going to Port Vale, Leeds United I went to West Brom, but on the back of the Port Vale one, I went to Aston Villa, and the minute I saw the place, it wasn't a case of them wanting me, it was a case of me wanting to go there. I just loved the place.
What age is this then?
That I went to Aston Villa when I was about 13. So, you know, and that was just to go down, not on a trial basis, you just basically were invited down. I was allowed to train and watch the training just with the apprentices, even at that age. It's a crazy world, you know, because that's just not the case of things these days. And I just ended up going there. I was offered an apprenticeship, and once I was offered that apprenticeship, that was where I was going to go, you know. But the great thing was, I'm going fast forward because I have to say this, but in 1998, I joined Stoke as the manager, and Sir Stanley Matthews was around the club, and he remembered me, which was brilliant. Amazing. You know, as a kid, he said, "I can still remember you as a young boy. I remember you coming to Port Vale. I remember I wanted to sign you." So that was fantastic, really. You know, so for him to have remembered that was one of my greatest sort of moments.
What age did you actually relocate then down to?
I left home when I was 15.
15.
My mum and dad took me to Durham Station, gave me £1 shilling and said, "Go away.
See you Christmas, Brian. All the best, pal. All the best."
So, you know, I had £1.10 in my pocket when I was 15 year old. And
brilliant.
I was lucky. I had great digs. I was in digs with a lady and a fellow called Mr. and Mrs. Mallard, who were brilliant to me. You know, they treated me like I was their son, and it was fantastic. So I stayed with them till I was 21, which was great. Wow. So I was very lucky. Those sort of things worked for me. But at 15, I hadn't even played for Durham County Boys. You know, I think I was obviously a fairly good footballer, but I wasn't coming down to Aston Villa as an England schoolboy international. When I joined, we had three Scottish schoolboy internationals. We had two English schoolboy internationals, and then like a gaggle of local lads and me from the northeast. But by the time I was 17 year old, I was in the first team, which was quite incredible, really. So I'd picked the right place, obviously.
Who was the manager who gave you your debut then at 17?
Vic Crowe. Vic Crowe would have given me my manager. But Tommy Doherty was my first manager. And Tommy had a real torrid time at Villa. I remember as a kid, 15-year-old, I used to be the tea boy, so I had to take the tea into the first team dressing room.
Getting hammered,
you know,
on the way
and
in.
You some of the things you heard at 15, was, you know, because they didn't like the manager, you know, they weren't happy with him, and he was really rough on them, and there was a real horrible feeling, and I learned so much I taught myself something at 15. I taught myself to look, listen, and learn, learn what was good, learn what was wrong. Try and learn what was right, but some of the things were outrageous. You know, and that season Aston Villa were relegated to the third division for the first time in their history, which was not a surprise because Tommy just couldn't get on with the players. It was really quite to say volatile. It's not even volatile. It was worse than that. It was poison. Absolutely.
I remember you telling this, Gaffer, about the story about when you were at the bottom of the hill and he was like, right, put him on your back and run up the hill, and refused, didn't you?
I did, well, that was more like I would say a year or so later, but Tommy Docherty, my first day's training with Tommy Docherty taught me something else about not that I'd realised it at the time, but we just ran and ran and ran and ran until everybody, including, and I was 15, you know, we had, there was like a group of 15-year-olds training with the first team players. There was 42 professionals at the time.
And who were they? Who were the top ones?
Because obviously, they'd just signed Bruce Rioch. They'd signed Bruce Rioch for £100,000. He was the first £100,000 player at the club, and his brother Neil Rioch played with him as well. But we had people like Trevor Hockey. We had people like Jeff Fowden. We had eventually Andy Lockhead came in. He wasn't there. So Willie Anderson, who played for Manchester United, was part of it. So the club were expecting to do really well in the second division as it was then. But as it turned out, they got relegated to the third division. Well, there's so many things. There was great things that I can remember. I remember a lad called Barry Hall, who was a Welsh international player. And Barry used to smoke 2 cigarettes at half time, which was, I found that really quite
unique. Oh, you, Sam, wasn't it? You know,
he used to light a cigarette, sit there with his leg crossed. And then when he'd finished his cigarette, he should light the second one with the end of his cigarette.
That's brilliant.
And he always used to just
sit at Wolves, Dave, when you were there. They'd not do that.
So
we had one actually.
A different era altogether. Yeah. You know, it was really different world. You know, and I was the tea boy, and I learned so much so quickly about how important it was to be in the first team for them lads, because the money wasn't great. If you played in the first team, you got like probably twice your wages.
So your wages would have been low wages. What would your wages have been?
I don't know what the senior lads. I was on £5 a week as an apprentice first time round.
Surely not when you got in the first team.
When I signed my first contract with Aston Villa was £14 a week, and that I played in the first team on £14 a week. Yeah.
So amazing, isn't it?
It was like,
get your nice ice in Birmingham.
You know. Most of the players lived in club houses. They didn't own houses. Yeah. Most of the players lived in the club owned houses all over Sutton Coalfield and areas like that. So all the players who came in were given a club house to live in, the senior players. So it's a complete, you know, football today compared to football in the 70s. Is like it's a different world, completely different world, and I think people find that hard to understand. But you know, it was an era where, you know, as soon as the first team sheet went up on a 1 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, there was people throwing their boots across the room and everything because they weren't in the team, they weren't going to get appearance money, they weren't, you know, they were living on their basic salary. A lot of them were married with children and things like that. It was a real cruel, hard environment to watch. You know, I was only a young lad, it didn't affect me, but I learned an awful lot from
people's
seeing
livelihoods, people's livelihoods.
Depended on it, though, getting the team.
And it was, so I worked in that era as a young footballer where it was massively important to train. And Friday morning training sessions before the team went up, it was like killer ball, you know what I mean? It was like every pro would play. We often played with the pros, so it was like 60 people in the car park. We played and trained on the car park on a Friday morning. I was here, honestly. And it was like a case of three or four people were out because they'd split their eyes open and stuff like that. You know, it was murder, wasn't it? So I love seeing the game today, and I love the way the game has developed. It's fantastic, really.
I know... amongst them 60 lads, there must have been a lot of big characters, Gaffer, and I know you were at the club for a long, long period of time, but I remember you talking to me about like your strike partner, the likes of Andy Gray, a lot of tough men, a lot of really strong men. Who out of those guys, who were the sort of top characters, top players that you played with? I know that's a real broad question.
Well, Bruce was always a real character in the dressing room and on the pitch. He and Trevor Hockey, I don't know if you've ever heard of Trevor. Trevor used to play with rugby boots on, you know, and things like that. His job was to go out there and mess the opposition up. But George Curtis was an unbelievable character who was 6 foot tall and 6 foot wide. You know, I mean, honestly, just, you know, typical centre-half, couldn't run in the day, but was as hard as nails. Then the big one that affected me most of all was a lad called Andy Lockhead, who was a centre-forward. And Andy, he was the first man I ever played football. In fact, I used to call him Mr. Lockhead when I played alongside him. You know, I mean, I was like 17-year-old in the first team. And he always used to say to me, if I win my battle today, Brian, we'll win the game. He convinced me that the battle between the centre-half and the centre-forward was the key the key element in the game.
That would have been a proper battle as
proper
well.
Battle. Like
a scrap.
And he used to say to me, you run around, you look at me, when the ball's coming at me, because I'm the focal point of the team, there's a 10-yard circle around me. Around something me. Will drop in there.
He said, whichever way it goes, it's going to drop. Yeah.
Occasionally he'd say to me, you know, you might see a bit of blood hit you on the face, because there was, I mean, it was really a rough game in those days. It was, and the physicality side of it was the thing that that really stood out more than anything else. It was... yeah, so Lockhead was a great character for me. I was blessed with centre-forwards. Lockhead, Andy Lockhead was majestic, fantastic
so
man.
So you always played as like with a big man up top?
Well, I went as a young midfield player, and Frank Upton, my youth team coach, after 6 months said to me, I'm going to play your centre-forward. And I said, I can't play centre-forward. It's too rough up there. He said, no, you're a goal scorer. You know, you're a creator. You will do this. And he changed my whole career, really. Which was fantastic. But I played with Andy Lockhead, who helped me initially with the physicality. Then a young lad called Keith Leonard, who only played for 1 year in the first team, who again was 6'2", 6'3", hard as nails, fantastic. And then Andy Gray came along after that.
Andy Gray and myself, as
the game was developing, it was changing now. You know, we were better football. It was football. There was more football being played. I felt that I played early 70s, last minute of the 60s. That was a physical game in those days. But
he was hard, though, wasn't he? Kevin Ratcliffe used to told me that Andy Gray was tough.
Andy was brave. Yeah. I call him brave rather than tough.
Right.
You know, I mean, as his partner, I could put the ball...
Braver than you when you were...
Yeah, absolutely. There wasn't many players.
Andy, sorted out.
But I used to just see Andy, and I could easily say, if I put the ball in front of Andy Gray in the box, he would attack that ball. He was brave, you know, and that's what I would say.
He
wasn't massive. He was 6 foot, but he could leap like, you know, the proverbial salmon sort of thing. He was brilliant. He was great to play with. And he was... loud and leery. You know, he was one of them lads that so many people loved but a lot of people didn't like, because when he was in the dressing room or when he was in a room, he was the centre of attention. But
like
he was
Gav.
A little bit like Gav, yeah, absolutely. You've got it there.
Hard as nails.
So he was great, but he was great for me. And it was a great partnership. And the 1 year, there was a lad called John Dean as well. Do you remember Dixie Dean? Well, the three of us scored 77 goals between us in one season.
What division were you in here?
So that's the top one
when you play with Andy Gray.
So Andy Gray, John Dean, and myself in 77 scored scored 77 goals between us in the league, which was amazing. I mean, that if they were doing that today, you'd be jumping down, going, "Wow, look at that!" So that was probably that was the highlight of my career that particular season. Lots of people today. That was the basis of the team that went on to win the European Cup. There was four or five of us dropped out, but Saunders had started to develop a team that could win major tournaments, really.
Talk about highlights. What about the League Cup?
League Cup's been great for me, you know. I mean, in 75, we got to the final to play Norwich. On the back of my performance there, I know Don Revy was at the game. He picked me for the England group in that summer, which was fantastic. But we had a good season. I think I scored 24 goals that year.
In the top division?
And that was the second division. We were a second division club and won the Coca-Cola League Cup in 75. So in fact, the final was between ourselves and Norwich, who were both promoted.
And you scored in the final?
Ray Graydon scored in the final. 77, I scored two in the final. Three in the semi-final. The 77 was the year that our team was like, it was just, we were immense going forward. So, but 75 and 77 winning the Cups. And the great memory for that was, for me, 75, my brother Alan played in the team with me. And he scored in one of the major games. Well, we played Colchester. We were struggling like crazy away from home. Alan scored in that game. Then he played with me against Hartlepool, who we also played on my 21st birthday. And I scored two against Hartlepool in that game. So that the League Cup has a family thing for me. I always think of my brother, and it's, you know, he had a good career in the lower leagues, which was nice. But the League Cup was great for me. 75 got me into the England squad. 77, I was gutted that I didn't get into the England squad because of the goals that we'd scored that season, you know. But Trevor Francis was established in the English team by then, so... And there wasn't the games that there are today. It was, again, a different sort of setup.
What was your experience like when you did get the call up and go to that camp?
I loved it. I mean, I think I was I talk a lot now because I've got to talk a lot. I'm used to talking now. I'm an ambassador at the club. I go out and in amongst the fans, and over the years as a football manager, I used to talk, but I was very shy, you know, and very quiet as a young footballer. But people, because I had long hair and I was a little bit scruffy, people used
flamboyant, you described on Wikipedia.
Yeah, people used to think I was like a bit of a, you know, but I wasn't. I was really quite serious, but I loved to show off on the football. I always said to football players, I probably said it to you, Sam, I'm not sure I said it to you, Gab, but the football stage, football field is a stage where you go out there.
Oh, Gav knew it was a stage.
Normally, Gav, you just said, Gav, just head it and kick it. You'll be fine.
So I loved the stage. I loved it, and I loved to. It brought out something in me that I can't believe in, because, like I say, when I was 15, I was like, wasn't even a Durham County footballer. At 17, I was flicking the ball over my head, even in training, you know, and the manager going, "How's he done that sort of thing?" And, you know, nutmegging people, but calling nutmegs while I was doing it, you know, even though, like, there was people who would kick you.
Yeah.
So I don't know where it came from.
It's got to be the appropriate time to bring up the scissor kick. The scissor kick in training. To set the scene, we're all in training. I think it was pre-season, Gaffer?
Probably.
Obviously at Gainsborough.
At Gainsborough, and we're training.
The Gaffer's, it must be nearly 60.
I was 60 probably.
60 odd. And the Gaffer's in training, best player obviously. Just one touch, two touch, no one get near him. And then I think the ball's come just going over your head. And you've just done this scissor kick that's gone over my head, and I'm 6'5", and you've done this scissor kick, and it's just gone in the bottom corner. And Barnsley, the goalkeeper, stood there, looked at me. I've shrugged my shoulders, turned around, all the lads are just like, and then next thing you know, everyone's helping the Gaffer up. Yeah. You're right, Gaffer.
Get a fizz, Gaff,
just get, help me get up. I was like, Gaffer, you've got to stop doing them sorts of things. Like, you're a bit old for that now. You go, I'll be all right. And then I think when we dropped off, you told Lizzie when you got home, and she'd had a go at you as well.
I mean, overhead kicks and things like that were just part of it. I did things on the pitch that...
60-odd though, Gaffer, to be fair.
Yeah, but when I was playing, I used to sort of... I'd do just anything.
Try
was outrageous.
Yeah.
And, Ron Saunders, who... I know he thought I was... But he would never give me an inch, you know, so he used to hammer me. Like, you know, he used to be saying... Like, I remember taking a penalty once, and I can hear him shouting, "Don't let him take the penalty." I'd scored two. It was right on half time, because he knows I'm going to do something stupid. And I'm telling the lads that I'm going to try and nutmeg the goalkeeper. You know, I'm going to say... So I'm saying to the lads, I'm going to nutmeg. And they're going, "No, don't take it. Yeah. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it." And I can hear Ron Saunders shouting from the sidelines, "Get him off the ball. He can't do this." Well, he saved it to say that. And I got hammered in the dressing room at half time. He absolutely destroyed me. But then I just laughed it off and went out and scored a hat trick in the second half and got on with it, sort of thing. So
what was Don Revy like when he obviously picked you for England?
Quiet. And it was funny, really. It was a very Leeds orientated sort of. The lads all told me.
What was that, 1975 then?
75. But again, you know, you look at the build up and the pre match. Sort of whatever you want to look at it, there was nothing there. You know, we don't have sports scientists. You don't have analysts. You don't have, you know, you've got a manager who's talking to you. And even the night before the game, we were playing bingo, and then we were like putting a boy, like playing little golf on you know, like just putting on like an imaginary putting green, and putting the ball in a hole at the end. And I'm like, I was like thinking it's going to be different this, you know, it's going to expand from there. But that's how it was in those days. Yeah. You know, there wasn't any real science to it. It was about the manager picking a team and the team going out with the belief that they could play. There wasn't a practice of how it's going to work, what system you're playing. Basically, you got their team was out and out, you went and played football. Simple as that.
So
it was very simple.
It's fair to say then, Gaffer, it's reliant on the players, their
very
characters,
so,
their ability.
Even when I became a manager, that was pretty much the case. You know, it was about, I didn't have any sort of scouts. I relied on games that I'd seen, people that I'd seen, I used to walk on the pitch after the game and I'd just nod somebody and say, "Well played today, I'll sign you one day," and walk off, sort of thing. You know what I mean? That's the sort of contact that you made with people. Because you just, it was all what, and again, in my managerial time, I've never had a technical director or anything like that. It was all about my build-up to it was retiring early, being a youth coach for 5 years, going around, doing scouting for the club, watching the games, and I learned about certain players, and I signed the players that I used to see play. I remember seeing Simon Grayson play for Leeds youth team, when I was the Middlesbrough youth team coach. And there was great players in the Leeds team. You know, Gary Speed was in that team. All sorts of good, really good players. Yeah. But Grayson stuck out to me as somebody, if I was at a certain club, I would want to sign him. So I signed him at Leicester, then I signed him at Villa. You know, I remember all those sort of things. I'd see certain games, certain types of football. My youth team days all were part of how I selected or bought players or sold. Whereas nowadays, you know, I go into Villa Park occasionally, I go to the training ground occasionally, and all the analysts are sitting watching games from all over the world.
There's loads of them as well now, isn't there? Loads of them.
And it's incredible, you know. Whereas in my managerial time at Villa, I had Alan Evans and John Gregory. End of story. It's two assistant managers, and we did everything. Absolutely everything, you know. So, and I was relied upon for what people were signing. So by then I was like travelling out to I used to like going to Holland to watch the Dutch lads played, you know. I thought there were some good players out there. And then when we got into Europe, I went further afield to look at players as well. But it was all me, you know. And then I think it must be great for them nowadays because, you know, oh, I mean, definitely. I right at the start, after 10 years of management, that's when I began to sort of dip over the edge, I felt, because I was just too, I'd had too much of it, to be honest. But, yeah, it was... It's funny how the game's changed, but it was all about even up to the 90s, it was all about the team sending them out there and relying on them, and the individuals could win you the game.
Going back before the manager yourself, but in the England squad, were you starstruck by anyone? Obviously, turning up and you're full of the best players in the country. Is anyone
something as well? Because you didn't see some of the games on television, or you wouldn't. There wasn't much on television. I used to say, "Oh, which one's Mick Shannon?" All right, well, you'd say, "Oh yeah, well, what you know?" Because I'd not played against them really.
Yeah.
You know, I'd not been in the first division, and I would say, which one, you know, Dave Watson? So you really didn't even facially know them that well. It was really weird. Yeah. But then the other side of it, and I remember the day I got picked, I remember the morning in the training session, I'd done a couple of silly things, well, not silly things, but I'd flicked it over my head and gone, and even all the lads there were like giving me a little clap because I was just a lad out of the second division, you know, only 20-year-old sort of thing. And then he picked me put me on the bench against Wales. So that was just incredible. But you didn't really know them that well. It's a funny thing to say.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I knew Jerry Francis and all these sort of people, knew of them, but never really knew them, so to speak. Whereas today, you just feel as if you know each other, don't you? They know each other really well. So it was a weird experience. And I was just a young lad and just made it. We just got into the first division from that promotion year. And the next thing I know, I'm in the England squad for the home internationals, as there were in them days.
Just going back to it there, Gaffer, you're saying about how the game's come on so much, the sports science, et cetera, et cetera. We've spoken on previous episodes, especially in Series 1, how although there's all that part of the game now, and it's obviously developed, and obviously for the good, you know, see the players nowadays and how it's all come along, but we still have always gone back to, even at, you know, at Dave's level, at Sam's level, at my level, all the way through those levels, we still all believe in that core value of having those brilliant characters, those players.
Yeah, you know, the thing is now, you know, the young lads are being brought into the game at 10, 11, 12 years old. They're taught about what they eat and what they shouldn't eat, what they should do and shouldn't do. If they have an injury, to take it easy. I mean, in my day, I played injured more times than I played when I was fit, sort of thing. So, but they're being schooled from the age of 12, you know, about this certain thing, doing a certain role, the way they play. You know, have a holding midfield player, you hold. You know, if you're a striker on your own, this is how you work, and they're just bringing them up in such a way. By the time they're 19, 20, getting in first teams, they have this school of thought now. You know, they're trained in a different way. Just as when I was 11-year-old, I was playing under 15 football. You know, I mean, I've got a couple of pictures at home, I could tell you. I'm like tiny. 2'6", standing next to these lads who are in the same school as me, but playing with them. And you look and thinking, wow, did I actually play? Yeah, of course I did. And 15, training with the first team. You know what I mean? But that's not happening now. So we're developing a different type of football
I worry it's taking away those special players, the Mavericks, the ones who don't know why they do things, but it just happens on a pitch, like Gazza and Rooney and players like that.
Well, I think
they're all coached, like you said, in that very same way.
We had the Rodney Marshes. We had the, you know, I mean, Stan Bowles, who was like one of my sort of favourite type of players. And even Dennis Stewart at Man City. Years ago, I went to watch Sunderland youth team, and I saw Dennis Stewart play, and I thought, oh, wow, I want to be like that, you know. I mean, a lot of people might not really recognise that game, but he was one heck of a player, Dennis Stewart.
Gaffer, tell us about, I remember being in the car, me, you and Gav on the way up with Wardy. We're talking about the best players we played against, and the gaffer didn't see anything, did he, Gavin? Me and you were talking, you threw in Jeff Minton and that, hadn't I? I was giving it like Kevin Phillips. And I went, in the end, I went, what about you, Gaffer? You played, it was the best one you've played against. Anybody decent? And you went, one player who I thought was really good. I went, go on then. He went, Johan Cruyff. And I went, oh yeah, I went, I've heard of him, yeah. He was good.
Like, oh, where'd you play against him, Gaffer? He's like, New Camp.
He's the best you've played against. Yeah. What was he like? He was incredible.
When we played Barcelona in the 77 season, and we played at Villa Park, and Cruyff came off injured after 66 minutes, and the entire crowd clapped him off the pitch. The Villa fans and everything. But I also played against Beckenbauer, if you want another one. I'll stop there. But no, Beckenbauer and it was different. You know, we had some really
good games. He's the best you've ever played against.
Cruyff was incredible. I had a picture taken with him once, and I can't believe they got him.
You showed us the picture, guys. Yeah. You're walking off the pitch.
But in the game, it wasn't. It was during the game because in the game once, he did that incredible left foot over and right foot, and he'd gone. And within 5 yards, he'd gone past me, and I remember thinking, where is he, sort of thing? You know, he's just incredibly quick. He was
levels, isn't it?
Cruyff was unbelievable. And he was the start of people trying to do something different with the ball.
No, I tried. He used to try that.
So he obviously sticks out in my mind. But there were some great English players, like I say, Stan Bowles and people like that. I used to play against Marshy and all that. I always wanted to play against George Best, who was my hero. And we were supposed to be playing Fulham this one weekend, which we were. And Besty was playing in the team with Roddy Marsh, and I'm dead excited, like, because we're getting there. Yeah. He didn't turn up for the game, did he?
Probably got a better offer around the corner, didn't he?
He'd gone somewhere else. And I've met him a load of times afterwards, and I used to ask him about things, and he wouldn't tell me where he'd gone on that particular occasion. But I was, as I say, fortunate to spend quite a bit of time with him at certain functions over the years, and he became a really quite a good friend of mine, Besty, which was made up sort of stuff, really.
Some of the guys you mentioned there, Gaffer, unfortunately aren't with us anymore. But is there any of them, like, I know you mentioned to me about Andy Gray, or any of those guys that you played against that you do get to catch up with or see, obviously, on the football circuit?
Well, yeah, I Roy McFarlane makes me laugh. You know, Roy, who was, when he Roy started to come into the game, he was classed as a new breed of centre-half because he was quick. You know, it was really fire some hard, tough people when I played. And then Roy McFarlane came in as the new breed of centre-half who could run, who read the game well, who could pass the ball well. And I did a little Q&A with Roy at Villa Park a few years back now. And someone said, did you two ever play against each other? And I went, yeah, I did. I played against Roy a couple of times. And Roy went, yeah. So he said to Roy, did Brian score? He went, yeah, he scored two in the first half. He said, well, what am I then? He said, so I just kicked lumps out of him in the second half. So he'd abandoned this new breed centre-half and kicked lumps out of me from there on in. So, yeah, but he was good. But the player who made me worry about my career the most was Paul Madeley at Leeds United. You know the great Leeds side with Bremner and Giles and all of them in? That was our, when we got to the first division, it was our first home game at Villa Park. Bear in mind, I've just been in the England squad. Bear in mind, everybody's jumping up and down about me. I'm getting my face on the front page of papers and God knows what else. And we play Leeds at Villa Park, and they beat us. They hammered us 2-1. Hammered us. I mean, 2-1 says it was a close game. But honestly, I cried when I went home. I thought, I'm not good enough. Madeley was just unreal.
Physical.
He man-marked me. Just man-marked me. Yeah. And I was thinking, I'm going to, you know, I've just been scored 24 goals in the second division, just being picked for England. I'm flicking it over my head. I couldn't get a kick. I could not get, honestly, he just completely blotted me out of the game. I went back to my digs and I sat, and Mrs. Mallard said, what's up with you? I said, I just don't think I'm good enough. I've got no chance at this level. Because he was just, and that team were, although they were hard, and if you can look back at and watch them play, and you can see games where they were really tough. My God, they could play football.
We spoke about that in the first season, didn't we? There's always a moment in your career where you realise there's another level.
Yeah.
And it's disheartening when it happens, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. That for me. But it also made me determined to get my head down and try. But he was an exceptional player, Madeley. I would genuinely say he was probably the best player I ever played against in that respect, because he taught me so much. He taught me to really get myself sorted out, you know, concentrate on was the different ways I could have played against them and all sorts of things. And people didn't think I thought like that in them days because I had long hair, you know, and was a bit... But I was very thoughtful about what I wanted to do. But he taught me a lesson, and that was to get your head down, get stuck in, remember what you've got to do.
And you played with, like, some amazing players, played against some amazing players. You were an amazing player yourself, Gaffer, but obviously it all come to an end a bit premature, didn't it?
Yeah.
26, was it?
26, I last played. I played the last year when I was injured anyway. I mean, as I've said, it was a strange leading up to it. It was a strange thing. We played in the quarter-final of the FA Cup against West Ham, and we got to the 91st minute. We had three senior good players, Alan Evans, Andy Gray, and missed the game. And we went to West Ham, and we needed to draw if we could. 92nd minute, they got a penalty. Ray Stewart scored. And in those days, if we'd drawn that game, we would have had a replay on the Wednesday against West Ham. As it happened, we lost because of the penalty. So we played Wolves on the Monday night. And that game on the Monday night, I did my knee, and I knew straight away. I knew that I'd struggled. It was obviously my cruciate and stuff like that had gone. And I knew then that I was going to struggle because they couldn't do anything about cruciate ligaments then. And that game, Wolves won the League Cup final the weekend after because Andy Gray was suspended for the game we played at Villa Park, which we had to play in. And then Andy scored the winning goals for Wolves in the League Cup final, wasn't it, that weekend after. But I injured my knee. And I always think about this. I always think I was like 2 minutes away from not injuring my knee sort of thing, you know. And there's like, you just often think
was
about
it,
that.
Was it a tackle?
It was a tackle. And my knee just completely went underneath me.
Gaffer, if they couldn't do anything about ACLs then, there must have been so many players.
Yeah, there's a lot of good players who retired very early, you know. Or not so much early, but anyone who did their cruciates and things like that, they were just basically... I played on for quite a bit after that. I mean, but I used to play on I've had more injections in my knee, and they used to say to me, look, just rest all week and play on the Saturday. And I'd play on a Saturday. And then it got to the point where they're saying, oh, you did all right again on Saturday, you're still playing well. And I'm going, you can't feel my pain. You know, you don't know how, like when I go home on a Saturday night, how I'm like lying every night there with ice on my knee and I can't, and it's like throbbing away. But in those days, they'd encourage you to play. You know, it was like injection, have an injection, do this and play here. And I kept going. And then got to the point that I remember I played my last game at Manchester United, and I went in afterwards and I said, look, I need to see somebody who can really give me an opinion on this now. So they sent me down to Harley Street to somebody who was supposed to be the best in the best of the best. And he looked at all of the x-rays and all the things that were there, and he looked at my knee and everything, and he went, look, if you want me to, I will experiment on your knee. And as soon as he said that, I went, no, it's all right. Yeah. Just like he said, no, basically he said, that's just not going to get better at all. So
how do you cope with that mentally, though? Because nowadays you'd have psychologists and you'd have the aftercare and everything.
But again, no, with nothing, absolutely nothing. But Sam, what I would say is that for nearly 6 months, 7 months, I was playing in complete pain. Unbelievable. Why I was playing was
relief, sort of
desperate. Was it relief,
the club wanted me to play. The club wanted me to play. They would, you know, I needed to play. I didn't know nothing else. I was 26 year old. I mean, I had no qualifications, no nothing. There was no way I was going to get too much out of it or anything like that. So you continued to play, but it got to the point that even my head was saying to me, you've got to try and sort this out one way or another. So the irony is, my first game ever, game for Aston Villa as a kid, 15-year-old, was at Man United Reserves. I played in the Reserves when I was 15. And my last game for Aston Villa was Man United. So and my first game I played against Paddy Crerand, who was brilliant, who laughs and jokes with me because he can remember me. And I was told before the game, you're playing against Paddy Crowns, you're 15, you'll run him into the ground. Well, they carried me off after about 60 minutes. I couldn't get near him. And he was just, but Paddy was just too clever for me, you know. And I'm 15, I'm playing against one of the best players that is around. But I played my last game at Man United, and I remember after that thinking, I've got to sort this out. If there's a way to go, there's a way to go. I was fine. I really was fine because I'd had too many months of agony. I didn't know what I was going to do. I hadn't got a clue. I actually went to work in a printing company for 3 months, and I hated every single day of it. I was like, what am I doing here? So I went back to Villa Park, went into the club shop and asked if there was a job for me. And I worked in the club shop for 3 months. Which was unreal. I've gone from being behind the counter selling stuff. I just wanted to work at the club.
Biggest then, recorded sales in 20
really,
years.
The really weird thing was Tony Barton, who'd been the chief scout under Ron Saunders, was given the Villa job because Ron had left to go to Birmingham City. And I come out the club shop one day and Tony's in the car park and he waved at me and went, Brian, are you all right? I said, yeah, I'm fine. He said, how are you doing in the shop? I said, oh, it's all right. He said, just as long as I'm around football. He said, Keith Leonard's going with Ron Saunders to Birmingham. Will you do the youth course job for 3 weeks? And I went, yeah, of course I will. So I did it for 3 weeks and ended up doing it for 3 years. And that was the start of my coaching career. So out of bad, something good comes of it, you know. Yeah. But I never expected that.
Did you had any experience in coaching before?
No, really.
Just completely off the cuff?
No, but I found, because of how my mentality about treating people in a way you like to be treated yourself, I found it was like a duck to water, really. The lads loved it. I had some really good players, mind in fairness, you know. I mean, lads who... older lads, people like Paul Kerr, Dean Glover, all them were still playing with the youth team.
And you're still thinking like a player, though.
I still think like a player, and I could still show little bits. I mean, I'd join in little five-a-sides and little bits. I could still show them things. But I had people like Tony DiRigo, Tony Daly, Mark Burke. You know, there's some really good players. David Norton, Darren Bradley, who all went on to have really decent careers at different levels. So I was lucky. I had some good young players, but I worked hard at being a youth coach. I enjoyed it, you know, and I found, but I was lucky in the right place at the right time.
How old were you when you got your first manager's job then?
I would say early 30s, wouldn't it? I got my first caretaker manager at Wolves.
Yeah.
I went over, it was the infamous time of the Barty brothers owned the club, and there was three sides of the ground closed down, and it was in a right mess. I worked at Wolves for 3 months and never got paid. It was like one of them, you know, like on a payday, you used to get cheques given you and whoever got to the bank first got paid.
Yeah, that's what we were like, a chess and wacky races, wasn't it? Like that, it'd be like that, going, oh no.
So I went through that experience as well. And then I ended up being caretaker manager for 5 games, I think it was, 5 or 7, I can't remember. And I won my last 2 games. And then I got called into the boardroom and everybody's congratulating me, patting on my back, so you're getting the job, but they sacked me. Because Graham Turner was coming in as experience. So,
And you went to Darlington?
And then I went to Middlesbrough. I worked with Bruce Rioch at Middlesbrough for 3 years. I worked with Bruce Rioch and Colin Todd, who were incredible with me. And Middlesbrough went from the third division to the second division to the first division. I was the youth and reserve team coach with Bruce and Colin. And that's where I really wanted to become a manager. Bruce Rioch used to go to games every night of the week. And because I was in digs up there with him, we used to go to games. He was teaching me how about what. And he was the first player I met as a manager who never had to be called boss or anything like that. All the players could call him Bruce. And but he had an unbelievable relationship with Tony Mowbray, Gary Pallister, Colin Cooper. He had a good
some bunch. Good players there.
Had a great youth policy. And
the kids. Units there.
But I went to games with Bruce. We watched players together. And he really mentored me for 3 years. And after 3 years, I said to him, I just need to be a manager now. He said, well, hang on here. I said, no, look, I don't want to leave you at the last minute, so just get somebody in. And he brought Eddie Green, his youth team coach. And within 2 weeks, I'd been offered the Darlington job.
And that was in...
Because of Middlesbrough fans who were on the board at both clubs. There was families in that area. And a lot of them had said, well, give Brian a chance. They were bottom of the fourth division.
Yeah. A good success there, Gaffer, didn't you?
Well, the first 3 months, we were in the fourth division, we got relegated, but bottom of the league.
Oh, not so much then.
It was, seriously, I'd obviously done enough in that first 2 or 3 months to show them that I had something about me. And the last game of the season was at Scunthorpe. And the day before the Scunthorpe game, the chairman resigned. So a new fella got the job who became the chairman for the Scunthorpe game. And his first game as chairman, we got relegated out of the Football League. And he shouted, I got a message. I need a new chairman wants to see you on the pitch. So I thought, oh, right, he's going to sack me. So, and he said to me, his first sentence was, and bear in mind, this is his first game. He said, if you go, I'm going. I went, what? He said, wow. Look, if you're leaving this club, I'm leaving this club. I said, you've just been chairman for one game. He said, I don't care. If you're leaving, I'm leaving. Which was an incredible sentence, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
And we won two championships together. Wow. And the last day with him, he said to me, because I'd done really well, and we'd had a few phone calls from different clubs at different times, and that we just won this, we got promoted from the fourth division to the third division, which was the second in a row. He called me and said, I've just had another one of them calls. He said, but I think you need to talk to these. And it was Leicester. So he was brilliant again. Which was incredible.
What was he called? A lot of chairmen do that.
Richard Corden. He was brilliant. And
Why do you think in that moment when he got you on the pitch, what was that? Obviously, he'd been doing his due diligence, watching the games prior to taking over the club.
Yeah, he'd been on the board, but he didn't want... He was a really quiet fella, but he just said that to me. He just said, well, if you go on, I'm going. I'm not staying here without you.
Wow.
So that, and then he gave me just full licence to leave to go to Leicester City, which was,
What division were they in at the time then?
We won the conference and the fourth division, so went to the third.
Yeah.
Leicester had just finished fourth off bottom in the championship, the second division. Yeah. In fact, they'd avoided relegation on goal difference, I think, and they offered me the job. And obviously, Richard Corden allowed me to go, chatted to Leicester, and I couldn't say no. It was the right sort of opportunity for me. Good club. I'd always liked playing there. Always a good crowd.
Filbert Street,
definitely. And I was off and running as a manager.
Did you have to do any sort of badges or anything
I'd done my full badge when I was at Middlesbrough, the youth coach, yeah.
Middlesbrough.
Which was like, yeah, you'd done your... Bruce had encouraged me to do that.
Like your A-licence?
A-licence, yeah. I can't remember. I'm getting old. Yeah. I can't remember the names. So I'd done all that. And because when the new routines came out, because I'd managed for something like 500 games by then, I automatically was given that particular license at the top end. But, Leicester was brilliant for me. I had three incredible years there.
I read on the internet, I think it was Leicester, where like you got rid of the pool table and said about punctuality and all that sort of thing. So you're
I was a bit of a stickler for...
I can't really imagine you being...
Yeah,
you
know? No, I was really into my work at that
time. You made them like dress smart?
They had to be clean-shaven on a match day, which was the biggest one, which really didn't. I mean, when I think of how I was as a lad.
Yeah, you know, but that's what I mean. You weren't like that as a player, were
no,
you?
No, but I sort of put into place. I hated fining people, so I tried to make fining people fun. So, I like all the little flip-flop things. You know, if you're in the shower without your flip-flops on, you're fined £5. Yeah. Absolute maximum fine, £5. Everything I did, £5, all for a laugh and a joke.
Yeah.
Because the lads then used to set each other up, didn't they, really? Yeah, yeah. And it was like brilliant, a bit of a team bonding thing. And then at Darlington, I used to find the lads with poetry. I used to send them a poem related to how whatever the fine was about. So I used to send them, so I wrote about 500 poems in my time. Yeah. I used to find them if they said, oh, the train was late. I'd write a poem about the train being late and everything. Anything silly, I did a real... But I made it like to try and give the team a spirit and a little bit of a laugh and a relief, and the players to mess each other around. You know what I mean? The number of times people were hiding people's flip flops or taking their shirt off and hiding their shirt out the way somewhere, or all the silly things. And I made that like so the bonding bit of the team was based on having a bit of fun, messing each other out, as players loved, but never hammering anybody.
Yeah.
Never doing anything.
What happened to the fine money? Was that
charity?
Okay.
Charity. I would never.
The Brian Little first, Fund.
They always started off. We always had this one. Oh, is it for the drink session at the end of the season? Absolutely not. No, absolutely not. Because I don't do that anyway.
What were you like with the lads going out drinking? By the way,
I didn't have a problem if it was the right time. Yeah. But I always. I mean. Over the years, there was always the odd problem that came in. The number of times you get a phone call in the middle of the night and you go, oh, crikey, what's happened to you sort of thing. You know, so I've had a few of them. to the point that I stopped the phone calls coming to me, sort of thing. And Jim, when I was at Villa, Jim Walker used to have to handle them. And Jim could only phone me after midnight if it was absolutely necessary.
If one of the lads is locked up.
Well, I got a phone call off a lad called Fernando Nelson, who I'd signed from Porto in Portugal, at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Brilliant.
Telling
this is what
me,
I want to hear, Gaffer.
It's a great start, that. Great start of a story.
Sounds like a girl's involved.
He told me that it was... He said, it's windy outside and the gate keeps crashing against the wall of my house. And I'm going, you are? He said, yeah, and it's keeping me awake. I mean, I can't tell you what I said to him.
No.
But that was the end. So from there on in... Jim Walker used to, but he was, so that was the sort of silly phone call. That's Premier League footballer in the late 90s ringing the manager to tell him he can't get to sleep because his gate is banging against the wind's blowing the gate. And I'm going, well, just lock the door, put a brick behind it or something you could have done, but I didn't even get to that with him. So that, and that led on to then some of the sillier things when Jim had to ring me. He rang me about a lad called Sasha Churchage one night. Sasha was a great player,
wasn't he?
Sasha
loved Stan Collymore and Stan and Ulrika were together.
Was Stan
at the time.
Stan Collymore a good role model?
I like Stan. Stan and I are the best of friends. He's my mate. I love Stan.
Go on, Sam, what were you going to say about Stan?
Yes, for sure. All right. I've stopped you there.
He's blocked me on Twitter. Anyway,
so he should. Sasha loved Stan. He just admired Stan. And Stan was going out with Ulrika at the time and often went down to London. Sasha would go with him.
Yeah.
And Sasha sort of saw the great big lights of London. And then I get this phone call late in the morning of Jim going, got a problem. And I'm going, what's up? Everybody was fine at training. Yeah, Sasha. I'm going, what's wrong with Sasha? And Jim got this next sentence out quicker than you could ever get it out in this, and put the phone. He went, he's in London. He's having a nose job at 8 o'clock in the morning. He won't play on Saturday. Put the phone down.
He's having a nose job.
He missed 6 weeks of football.
He went through with it.
He had a nose job at 8 o'clock in the morning. He had a Roman nose, and then he came out with this tiny little pert nose. But he couldn't play for 6 weeks.
Can you find him for that? I could find him
2 weeks' wages or get rid of him. Which cost me $3.5 million.
Did he sign for Palace?
He went to Palace later on, but that was the sort of things that happened. But Sasha did that twice. He had two operations, which made him miss certain games in the middle of the season.
What is he thinking there?
I want to see a picture of his nose original. His original nose.
So that sort of thing happened. Silly things like that, you know. And then I'd get phone calls in the middle of the night about players having a party and things like that, and you go, oh, I just don't need this.
Who were the main culprits, Gaffer?
Oh, Yorkie loved a party.
Yeah.
Yorkie was brilliant. Dwight York could go out, probably could have gone out every night of the week and still played brilliant on a Saturday.
Yeah. I seen him at Marbella once.
Yeah, he's a great
lad. He was playing pool and that, but he had like shades on inside and that, and the football. He still looked cool. I'm not having that.
Dwight was an immense talent.
Yeah.
What
was his attitude to treat?
Brilliant.
But I can imagine he would have loved you because you would have gone, I'm not going to get you, Dwight, to run up them hills.
No, we didn't.
Because he doesn't need to do that.
No, what I would say to you there, Sam, is if I felt it was right to run up a hill, we would have run up a hill.
Yeah.
However hard training was, I would always use the analogy and I'd say to the players, when I was your age, I would do this because this is what I would need to do to get there. But I will never make you do something that I wouldn't have wanted to do myself. I just wouldn't do that. So I got on really well with people like Dwight. But Dwight was the best trainer by far all the time. Miles, best runner. He'd be at the front of everything. But you see, what Dwight didn't have was the confidence to be the best player when I first went there. Because we had people like Dalian Atkinson, Dean Saunders, who were larger than life.
Yeah.
Dalian, God bless him, was a wonderful player, but was a character. Dwight didn't have that character in him. Dean, do you know Dean at all?
Yeah, he was my gaffer.
Well,
Dean's
the loudest person.
He's a funny man, isn't he?
He's a funny man. So Dean was always the number one. And I remember playing a game at Leeds United and I had Dean Saunders and Dwight York up front.
That's a forward line, by the way, isn't it?
But I remember after the game going, I've got to make Dwight the number one. I remember that game so clearly. And Dean's agent was the same agent as Dalian Atkinson had. Galatasaray and Fenerbahce were after the two of them. So I'd rang the agent and I said, look, just to mark your card, at the end of the season, the deal's on for them to go to Fenerbahce and Galatasaray. It's a done deal. You can have it. Because I wanted to make Dwight the number one striker. So that's how that happened. But Dwight was massively impressive for me. I thought he was incredible. And then I switched to my Ron Saunders mode of right-footed player, left-footed player, and I searched the globe for a left-footed young centre-forward. And
what do you mean, two? You wanted a right-footed centre-forward, left-footed
centre-forward? Yeah, because I look at Andy Gray and myself. I look at Gary Shaw, Peterwith, Villa teams that were the best that there was, right-footed, left-footed, you know, the contrasting players. And I'm obsessed with Ron Saunders' management styles. So I hunted around and I found Savo Milosevic.
Yeah.
Didn't know anything about him apart from some fella had been in touch with me, sent me a load of videos of him, which I started watching. And then I rang Terry Venables, so I knew he'd seen him play at international level. And he said, I tell you what, he's blooming decent. He's not the quickest. He's a goal scorer. He holds the ball up well. And he's from Partizan Belgrade, who produce players. So I said to Doug, I want this player. And I put the Milosevic. That was the final piece in my...
How much did you get him for, Gaffer?
3.5 million.
I remember seeing a picture of him and his wife in the paper. His wife was decent.
Yeah, it's a beautiful person. Really,
and that's
really
important. That's so important. That's so important.
Sam, you're still learning from me.
Yeah.
So that's how my new team developed. I had to change some of Ron's great players. You know, I mean, Ray Houghton was a great player. Kevin Richardson was the captain. Sean Teal.
So you had Sean Teal centre off. Kevin Richardson, the Geordie, isn't he?
Kevin was disappointed with me when I saw. But Ron, I knew Ron wanted him to go to Coventry. So I looked after him by letting him go to Coventry. Sean.
He's a hard man, Sean Teal.
Sean was my difficult one because I was worried about Sean and I didn't want to upset him. But And in fairness, I thought I had for 3 years of my life. And then I remember seeing him one day and I said, look, he went to Tranmere for got a 3-year contract off Tranmere. Yeah. And he said, Brian, no, you got me my pension. That was the best thing I could have done. Doug was going to give him a 1-year's contract. And I wanted to buy, I just bought Gareth Southgate. And I wanted to buy the other lad, the Welsh lad who played for Crystal Palace's friend, centre half.
Coleman.
I wanted to sign Chris Coleman, which I didn't sign because I ended up playing Gareth centre half. And I told Sean that I was trying to sign Coleman. And he went, well, look, I tell you what, I said, but I've just had a call off Tranmere. If you want to speak to them, I know they want to give you a good contract. But I was worried that I'd upset Sean because I liked Sean. He was hard lad, good lad. But I wanted a bit of youth in there and I didn't realise Southgate would have been the person for it. I'd signed Gareth as a midfield player, but tested him as a left-sided centre-back in pre-season. And it just...
Was he a lefty?
He was a right-footed player.
He was right-footed.
Was he a class act?
I you couldn't believe it. When you first met him, you knew you'd got a good person, a good man. When you started to play, and we went through our procedure of how we play three centre-backs, but we had, listen, Hugo Egge, oh, God bless him, Paul McGrath, Gareth Southgate. I mean,
that's decent.
I say to people, you know, did I have to coach them? No. I give them rules. We had a guideline of how we wanted to play, but Southgate, I never told how to play football once ever in my life. This is how we play, Gareth. This is what we do. This is what I don't want you to do. We don't play with a sweeper. So, you know, if Paul has to mark somebody, he has to mark somebody. We play that way. So just general chats, tried a few pre-season friendly matches, and we just straight away went, whoa, hang on, we don't need Chris Coleman. Look at Gareth Southgate. You know, we went chasing Draper then. So
he was good for you, Gaffer, when he drove past
Draper.
But the 96 team, my 96 team were...
What was the team that played in that final when you won it then? Can you
Bosnic,
remember?
Gary Charles, Alan Wright. Two fullbacks who never anybody would have picked up, but Gary and little Wright, he was brilliant. Hugo, Paul McGrath, Gareth Southgate, Andy Townsend, Mark Draper, Ian Taylor, Milosevic and York. And
good
that team. That.
Good
that
little team, mix.
But it wasn't so much, you know, like again, on paper you would say, where's the weaknesses? Fullbacks, blah, blah, blah. But that team was so together. I mean, the teams I've ever had, and I won two championships with Darlington, which was a great... Again, same basis, three centre-backs, three midfield players, two strikers, same basis, right and left foot up front. Do you remember David Little and Corky? Do you remember Corky used to play for Huddersfield? I signed him. David Cork. No. Nah, see, that's probably going back before your time. But I always had this plan, and my successful teams were identical to each other wherever I went. When I couldn't produce a team, a la Wrexham, a la Gainsborough sort of thing, where I couldn't get that matching up of a team, which I like to put together.
There wasn't many managers doing that, I suppose, when you first started doing three at the back.
No, we were pretty much... I think the Liverpool did it for... And Liverpool knocked me out the semi-final of the FA Cup, because with that season, we won the League Cup, finished fourth in the Premier League, and got to the semi-final of the FA Cup as well. So it was an incredible season. And we actually played better than Liverpool in the semi-final. But Robbie Fowler, who always scored against me, went and stuck a couple in the back of the net. Gareth got injured and had to come off. We probably could have won the FA Cup as well that year, to be honest. You know, a little bit unlucky. But that team was a real good team.
Got a good mix. I can look at
my Leicester team, you know, with Walshy, Colin Hill, and the three centre-backs, two strikers.
Who were your two strikers at Leicester?
Leicester, I would have had... Well, don't tell me Leicester's a difficult one for me, because I had... that was odd, because I had Phil G, who you wouldn't necessarily... Yeah, but Phil was quick and lively. Yeah. I had Sticks, Big Ormond Droid played for me, Ewan Roberts. Remember Big Ewan? So Ewan and Phil G were probably the ones who led that line for me. But that was a good... We had Darlington, Leicester, Villa, Tranmere. I can see that setup almost identical, but obviously different standard of play, but equivalent for that particular league. Really good. I mean, we took Tranmere into the playoffs, lost to Hartlepool on penalties. We were miles better than Hartlepool as well. So it worked for me, you know. I had a system which worked for me.
What was Bosnich like? These are difficult. Yeah, I remember you telling me that, like, if you were training and you had, like, the surface wasn't good, he was a bit awkward.
He was awkward, but he just knew he was good.
He's unbelievable.
He just knew he was good. I did some work with an Australian television company the other week, and they were saying, "Well, tell us about Bosnich and everything." I said, "Well, ask him about his roast potatoes, because he'd sometimes say, right, this week all I'm eating is roast potatoes." And everybody would be looking and go, "What are you doing?" He would eat roast potatoes all week and nothing else. Yeah. And then he'd come in some days and he'd stand there and go, "Gaffer, if we score, we've won, because nobody's scoring past me today." And he meant it. Like, he was genuinely in the zone, of his own zone. Nobody's scoring against me. And generally speaking, he was right. So he used to say to me, "If they score, if them two lads up there score today, we've won, because I am not letting the goal in today."
He went to United after Villa, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then he had his own little problems. But he was, for me, he was just eccentric. You know, just but great. Talent.
A lot of keepers like that.
Yeah, talent.
What about managing Paul McGraw?
Paul was hard work, because it was like, it's quite hard for me, because he had his problems, which we all know of. And every now and again, he would slip into a night where he would disappear, or a day where he'd disappear. And part of his mentoring was him coming into the manager's office with his mentor and probably his wife at the time, and apologising to me. And I used to say to them, "Well, he doesn't really need to do that." But they would say to me, "No, he has to do that. That's part of his rehab." So I always found that quite hard, sitting there with Paul McGrath apologising to me for being out and getting drunk sort of thing. But that was the way it was. But you knew with Paul, if you could get him to the Saturday morning, he'd play and he'd be brilliant.
And he'd be quality.
Incredible. He couldn't walk through. We used to just... Jim Walker again, incredible character, Jim Walker, who was my physio come first team mentor sort of thing, would walk around the training ground with Paul McGrath, just talking to him. And that's what he'd do on a daily basis. And then every now and again, there'd be a little later side going on, and you could see him jump.
Oh, join in that bit.
"Can I join in now, really?" And he'd come in and he'd play up. He'd never play at the back. He'd always play on the goal. He was a goal scorer. He wanted to play as a centre-forward. And he'd just mess around playing as a centre-forward. But on a Saturday, you just used to look at him and go, "You all right?" "Oh, yes, Gaffer, yes, I'm ready now." And he'd just
is it the occasion in Gaffer?
You know, it's a mentality thing as well, isn't it? I mean, we're all more aware about mental health and what makes you feel good and what brings you. Yeah, I'm not totally aware, but in those days, you learn to let that happen. But when you look back at it now, you know, it was just for his own mentality more than anything else. You know, so it was good for his health, good for his soul. He wanted to play on a Saturday, but through the week he obviously had demons, which were difficult for him to handle. So that was quite a hard thing to put up with. But he was a great lad, and you know, he would often. Alan Wright, God bless him, little 5'2" Alan Wright, was his guide through the week. Alan used to have to bring him down from Manchester.
Tough game.
And Alan used to lose him. Sometimes he'd stop at Keel and Paul would disappear. So Alan would ring me going, "Gaffer, I've lost him.
Keep an eye on him, for goodness sake, Alan. You've got one job.
That's the reason you're playing.
It's the only reason you're in the team, Alan. Get him here.
So Alan was like, you know, and Michael Oakes used to travel with them odd times as well. The second goalkeeper. So we had some real good times, but Paul would generally disappear and often find a bottle of vodka or something, and then they'd bring him in. Some days they'd bring him in, and when I was manager, as soon as you opened the doors, you could tell if there was something. Like, you head school teacher now, you must be able to open your doors, walk in, and go, "Hang on," something hits you, like, as you walk through the door, there's it's quiet or whatever. Or And then I'd walk down the corridor, and then I'd see McGrath sort of running down the corridor and popping his head round the corner and laughing at me and playing hide and seek. And you're going, "Oh, Paul, he's not training today, definitely," which he never would. But no, so there was all those sort of things to deal with.
Paul might have had a drink this morning.
But you loved him, you know, and everybody in the club loved him. And he's just a lovable person.
Because I know it hurt you, Gaffer, didn't it? Like, you had to be the one, really, to really sort of come to that time for him where he needed to move on, and that was hard for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, and it was harder for me because obviously Doug, Mr. Ellis, loved Paul. It was like he treats Paul like a son sort of thing, or he did do, and he wanted to give him a year's contract. And I said, "Well, look, let me have a chat with Paul. I know I've had a phone call off Derby County who want to give him, you know, a longer contract than we would give him, so we'll see where we get to." And I just, at the same time, we had young lad called Gareth Barry, who was coming through, who played centre-back at the time, who we thought was decent. And there were other things that we needed to do, and we just felt, I just felt that it was right to try and give him a couple of years somewhere else. I know Paul didn't agree with it at first, which was even tougher for me, but we went through with it, and I just said, "Look, Paul, I think that from my point of view, and it's important for me, while she played every game last season, I won't be playing you every game this season. There's no way." And I thought that would probably be more of a danger to his health, not playing all the games. Whereas he played every game, you know, he's got something to look forward to the weekend. If I was taking his weekend away for 3 weeks of every month, I wouldn't be doing him any harm. I wouldn't be doing him any good. So I explained that to him and said, "Look, you know, at the end of the day, Derby want you. They want you to play in the team on a regular basis. For me, for you, in your situation, playing football is the most important thing for you." So we came to an agreement that he went to Derby and he got a 2-year contract, but he only played for a year, I think, and then packed in.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to see Paul, his health or anything else, deteriorate because he wasn't in the team. I thought playing football was the thing that kept him together at the time. So
was it hard for the dynamic of the group, for you being a manager and you've got a player who doesn't train every day because he's in whatever night he's got up to, or state or whatever.
Yeah.
Was that hard trying to focus the other players or them to feel like, well, he's not training, so how do I keep those standards there?
I tell you what, Dave, any other player in the world, you would say yes. In fact, any other player in the world, it wouldn't happen. You wouldn't allow him to do that. But McGrath, honestly, he's just so unique. The lads loved him.
Yeah, they were there. That helps, doesn't it?
Every person at that club loved him to bits. He was the most gentle, humble, nice person. But he had a problem.
Yeah.
But I fully agree. I mean, there's just no way you would get away with it with somebody who was a decent player, who was all right, who somebody thought, well, I'm better than him. There wasn't anybody thought they were better than the McGrath.
You knew you were better than him.
And you've got to be some player, haven't you, Gaffer? Like, I get what you're saying, and obviously, you know, he comes across amazing, and I know all the things that you've spoken so highly of him. But if he wasn't great, you're not getting away with that.
No, you wouldn't get away with it. No. There's no way anybody else would have got away with that. He deserved all the recognition and everything that he has.
Class.
And I've seen him loads of times since. I did quite a bit of work out in Dublin for years, and I'd often see him on the aeroplane going back and forward, and you know, always give me a big hug, and he always was really sort of good to me.
So how did it leave at Villa then? Because obviously, when you left Leicester, you went to Villa, didn't you? And then. You had to go back to Filbert Street 8 days later with your team, didn't you? And obviously you got absolutely battered, didn't you, at Leicester?
I, That was the first time in my entire football career that I got battered. I've never had criticism.
How did you cope with that then?
I hated it. Yeah. It took me months to get over it, to be honest. If I'm being honest, yeah, I would say it had a...
You mean criticism from the fans?
From the fans, from the media.
Everybody is having a go at you.
People who I'd known and trusted for months. I mean, I Leicester supposedly were going to take me to court. They weren't going to take me to court.
Can you talk us through the...
It transpired. Look, Aston Villa wanted me to go to Aston Villa. Leicester City wanted me to stay. At the start, I said to the chairman, look, you know what, I'm not sure it's the right time. And then I remember going in speaking to John Gregory and Alan Evans, and they both said to me, Brian, if you don't do this now, you might not ever get an opportunity again. And I went and I sat and thought on that, and I stewed on that for a day. And then I went back to the chairman. I said, look, I've spoken to Alan and John, and the three of us are in a position where we just think it's probably something that we should take a little bit further. Okay, so that was an okay. So we'd push that on to that point. Then the chairman said to me, I need you to speak to the board. So I went in and spoke to the board and said to them, look, it's massively important that I leave now. I said, because to be honest with you, I've worked there for years and years and years. I love the club. I love it here. And they were great people. And I've gone, well, I said, but I've just got to do it. So if you would sort out some sort of compensation, that would be great. And they said, no, we're not letting you go. And me being me, and you might know me well enough to know, I looked at them and I went, so if you wanted to go somewhere for a job, yep, would you go there? Yeah, probably you would. I said, well, I'll tell you this now. I won't go to Aston Villa. I'm not staying at Leicester City. And if it means I never manage again in my life, I won't manage again in my life. And I meant it. And I walked out. So then I got something. They said, we need that in writing. So I said, okay. So I put it in writing. Like, I'd like to go to Aston, but if you don't let me go to Aston Villa, I'll just pack in football.
And that was like, so that's a principle thing for you, Gaffer. Like, you just felt that, look, do you know what? You should, like, you've got no reason to hold me back. No. We've had cordial conversations.
Yeah. But then, so what happened was, somebody, and obviously it was only the board that had that letter, took the piece out saying, I'm not going to go to Aston Villa. I'm not going to go to Aston Villa. And that was printed on the Sun the first day that I'd gone there. I'm not going to go to Aston Villa. So somebody somewhere within the club, don't know who, but somebody had used that one line out of that letter that I wrote them, and it became a headline on the Sun with, what was I called? Judas, that was it. Headline Judas, and the line underneath, I will not leave Leicester to go to Aston Villa, sort of thing. So it was like...
Have you still got that newspaper cut?
No.
I've been using that for the promo.
It destroyed me. And I remember that. So that was the morning. That piece was done the morning of my game back at Leicester City. So it played, and we'd played another game. We'd played Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah.
So somebody, whoever it was... I'd waited till the morning of the game, made sure the Sun did that article, I will not go to Aston Villa, and Judas on the very top. It was the front page of the Sun with Judas, and that was a national newspaper.
How did you get on in the game?
We drew 1-1.
Probably for the best, that.
Yeah.
didn't want to win, didn't want to lose.
Honestly, I mean, you look back and you got on with it, but it knocked me up.
Integrity, isn't it?
For me, I was like, yeah, it was... And it's taken, I tell you what, it took a good 10 years or so for it to calm down. And now I go back to Leicester and people are great because they said, you know, I mean, obviously they nearly went out into the third division. They did at some stage later. But they reckon that myself and Martin O'Neill did, you know, I set the ball in motion, sort of thing. Took the club back to, I mean, we did 3 playoff finals in a row. It was incredible.
Yeah.
We were laughing on the bus going down on the third one, going, what are we doing on the bus today?
Regular trip to Wembley
at the end of the season. And we had a good bunch of people, good rapport. We bought good players into the club. Never spent a lot of money. But we had the bases, the Walshes and that of this world, Gary Mills, you know, them sort of lads, real honest lads. But took in the likes of Agnew, Tomo, them sort of lads, Ewan Roberts, all them sort.
Yeah.
I actually thought, you know, my last game at Leicester in the final... I thought if I'd lost the final, they'd probably sack me after the 3 years of failing at the... And to be honest, the team I picked, they probably should have sacked me because I just... We played Derby, who on paper were miles better than us, a better team by far, you know, Kitson and all the lads, and Tommy Johnson, Charlo played for them. Yeah. Pembridge, little Mark, remember?
Yeah,
little
Pembridge.
They had a good bunch of young players, loads of good young players. Roy McFarland was the manager as well, which sort of confused it for me. But I played about five centre-halves in the team that day. I played Walshy centre-forward. I said, we won't beat them, lads. Listen, this is not a cup final at Wembley. This is a game where you're going out there, and I'm sorry, but we are going to bombard them. We're going to make it absolutely impossible for them. And we beat them 2-1 with Walshy scoring the winner, you know. But I picked Gary Coates with you. Remember, not know Gary Coates, a big centre-half. Jim Willis, I signed those two from Darlington.
I can't imagine you picking a team like that.
Honestly, I had to. Because of the team I picked with five centre-halves in, I knew that if I lost that game, everybody would have looked at me and gone, he's cracked, he's gone.
Yeah, he's gone.
He's gone. He's gone now. He's got no chance. He's
genius in the end, though.
It's one of them. I call them defining moments in football. I as a football manager, you get defining moments in football. Remember Rud Hullett when he left Alan Shearer out the team?
Yeah.
I sat at home and I'm going, Newcastle lose today, Rud Hullett's finished.
Yeah. And Duncan Ferguson left Shearer and Ferguson out.
Yeah. I've known them, and when I've often had them defining moments myself all over the place, and I know the day I went to West Brom and got the sack at West Brom, I knew I'd get the sack if I didn't win that particular game. So they're classics, but they are defining moments. But my Leicester one was, even though it was success, you know, three playoffs in a row, it was a defining moment for me. Because I remember Colin Gibson, who played midfield. He hadn't played at Gibbo, played with me at Aston Villa, little Gibbo, my mate. I call him the Tasmanian devil. Like, he's like a little, he's terror, he's a real terrier.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, Gibbo, you're playing. He went, you what? I said, you're playing. You're playing in there with a lad called Mark Blake, who had signed for Villa as well. Out and out hard lads. And the team I picked, everybody, the lads who were left out, I said, sorry lads, but I've got to try this today. This is, just trust me for the day, please. And that moment worked. But I if it hadn't worked, I wouldn't have been there. Because I can match it to other people's defining moments. You watch even football today, you look at certain things when people say something. I like the lad who, the Bournemouth manager,
Scott
when he was
Parker, yeah.
It's a defining moment. Yeah. You know, and there are loads of those in all up and down in different leagues. When I got the Tranmere job, they'd interviewed me on the Friday. They didn't have a manager. They lost 6-0. I knew I'd get the job on the Monday.
I got the
job on the Monday. Defining moment. I knew straight away.
How did you leave Villa then? How did that come about?
That was more personal than anything else, Sam. I'd done 10 years of management. My home life was in bits, you know, and it was a personal thing more than anything else. I remember sitting with Doug and him saying, well, look, Brian, just take some time off. We'll fetch John in to help you. Jen, you just sit, take some time. And I went, if John's coming in here, he doesn't need me sitting on his shoulder.
John Gregory.
Yeah, Gregor, my mate. John's a good friend of mine.
We always talk about him, didn't we? Because I was like, I'm not having him, Gaffer. John Gregor, I can't stand.
He loves himself. Stop talking, Sam.
He's my mate, and I call him Peter Pan because he thinks he's Peter Pan. He's having himself a little bit, Gaffer, isn't he? No, I wouldn't say. He's my mate, so I love Gregor.
We used to say to you in the car, though, Gaffer, didn't we? We used to go, he's like chocolate, Gaffer.
Gregor's lovely. He's a great lad. He's a good friend of mine. But Doug, I went in to see Doug, and I said, look, Doug, I've just got to get out. I need some time away. And if I have to resign, I'll resign. But as I was resigning, I was signing Gareth Barry in the other room because I knew we had to keep him.
Yeah.
So I finished off on a good note. But then Doug tried his best to make me stay. But I just had enough, you know. There was just too much going on in my life, which wasn't good for me. And I was the end of like 10 years of like non-stop
High pressure,
doing everything every day. I even designed the shirts at Darlington. I even designed the shirts, the strips at Leicester. Even them sort of things I did. I was like obsessed with all that. So I took over completely. Villa, the only person I had to answer to was Doug, which is completely different. You know, if I said to Doug Ellis, I want to sign him. If he said yes, or I could tell if he got excited. Oh yeah, that sounds good. But sometimes he'd go, no chance, Brian, and I'd just walk out because I knew it was a finish. But Doug was. If you look at Aston Villa, and the history is easy because it's in my head. But Aston Villa at Villa prior to this recent changes with Mr. Ellis in charge or other chairman beforehand, if you weren't sacked after 3 years, you left. because you were tired. It just tired you out. It was hard work, hard you know. Work. John Gregory, when John got the job after me, I said, I'll give you 3 years, Grego, son. 3 years, gone, went to Derby. Martin lasted nearly 3.5, nearly 4, but had enough, you know. It's just, it is that, it's a really, it's a hard, tough job, you know. It's a real pressurised area where only Saunders has managed to crack it, to be honest, in recent times, in the 50 years I've been around the club. Prior to that, it won all sorts of things. But only Ron Saunders was the man who's cracked it really with, and that's where I got most of my stuff from. But my 3 years at the end was basically, it was a culmination of 10 years non-stop football management, probably doing more than I needed to do even in that era. You know, taking too much responsibility, trying to do everything, doing all the scouting, making sure I'd watched players before I signed them, apart from Milosevic. And it just affected all my life, you know, and I just... So
needed a break.
I just needed a break, and I just had a little spell out.
So in that time then, Gaffer, obviously you've been at that top end, and you'd been obviously with Darlington as well. What were the biggest differences? What were the things that you noticed between the levels and the, well, the
firstly,
leagues,
the
other
money.
Than the obvious?
I mean, honestly, I used to sit in with Darlington, I'd be arguing with people, no, you're only, it's only £5 more. I'm saying, you're not having it. You're just not having it. You're not having that. That's it. That's the money there. So we had them silly things like that. And then the facilities. No, facilities were incredible. At Darlington, I mean, I used to have to go up the pitches that we trained on with a shovel to clean them up before the...
Well, obviously, you grew up then as well. After that, you come... They obviously had Stoke, West Brom, but then you came down and did, like, Wrexham.
Yeah,
I loved... at Wrexham. So you sort of, like, came back down the leagues a little bit again and had the same problems that you had previously.
Yeah, I tried. I kept thinking to myself, I'd enjoy it more lower down again. But it wasn't the case, you know. But I loved my time at Stoke. It was a good club, just the wrong time for me. I was a little bit early. West Brom, I shouldn't have gone to. I don't know. Even to this day, I've advised people, oh, you're a Villa man. You don't go to West Brom. You don't go here. You don't go there. West Brom was just I knew a couple of people there, and they asked me to go. And I was living on my own, and I had a flat in Birmingham. I thought, oh, ideal, I'll take the job. But the minute I lost a game, I just knew I was in the wrong place, you know? It was like, you have to win every single game to win the crowd, sort of thing.
Being a Villa man, obviously.
Yeah, so you got that, and I got that quite heavily at times. So, you know, I made a couple of wrong moves here, there and everywhere, but certain things I enjoyed. I certainly enjoyed Stoke. I certainly enjoyed Tranmere. I loved my time when I went out to Jersey to help them try and progress the football out there. And then I ended up the manager of the national team for But that was great because
what are the Jersey Bulls, Gaffer?
No, they're not now. They were before they went. I was manager of the representative side, and I actually managed the most important game in the country's history was the 100th Muratti, which is the big game between Jersey and Guernsey. And it was the 100th edition of it, and I managed to win it, and I resigned straight after.
I'm peaked now. There's nowhere to go.
So I've done it. So I won that game, and everybody was... Because they'd got rid of the manager before and said, Brian, you've got to step in. And I'm thinking, it's the 100th Muratti. I know all the history about this. And they were full-time by then. Oh. Guernsey were full-time, and Jersey were still very much part-time. Jersey are now full-time now, but at the time they were... And Guernsey were the favourites for the 100th Muratti. And they said, they convinced me to be the manager. And I went, OK, I'll do it. But we won 2-1, and then I resigned straight after the game. I said, that's it, I'm off now.
So you didn't enjoy managing lower level than what you did at the top?
I found it hard.
Different challenges?
No, I just didn't do so well. I don't know why. Wrexham, you would understand why. That was hard. Wrexham at the time when I took in there, I mean, it was just the most hard. I mean, it needed a complete turnaround. I was pleased that when Dean come, it was that Dean was the right sort of person for it. It wasn't the right job for me.
I remember you saying about that, Gaffer, that it was even like from the people in the canteen to the supporters, everybody was just on that.
Yeah, I was on the wrong page to them altogether. I mean, I went in saying, right, hang on, to all the staff, look, you're bottom of the league. We need to get a bit serious about this and a bit more. And they were going, well, but we've got to have a laugh and a joke. And I'm saying, I'm not saying you don't have a laugh and a joke. I'm just saying we need to get a bit more serious about it. You need to take things more seriously.
Done well signing me then.
And then you were the best signing, I'm telling you. But there was, and then I had this, you know, the there was just too many people against me. And sometimes you walk into a football club and you sense that straight away. You see it sometimes now. See someone go in and you think, ooh, that might not be the right place for him. And I'd love to see Wrexham get back to where they need to be because, you know, it's a good place. They're very much football orientated, but they didn't like me from day one. They didn't take to me at all, and it was just...
What do you think is the difference, though, Gaffer, between, like, the top players? I mean, speak to Dave about this. Like, why is, you know, like, Dave's done amazingly well, but why has Dave done so well when, arguably, I played with people who I would say were every bit as talented as Dave, bit as good, but yet didn't have the career.
Can you remember Lewis McMahon?
Yeah. Yes.
Lewis McMahon was a schoolboy international.
Ugly
England,
guy.
England, I know you he keeps, I know you're human.
He listens to
I know,
this.
Yeah, and I know he will listen
he listens to this.
Lewis
no
McMahon.
Banner.
Lewis McMahon,
ugly.
Youth international, played for Sheffield Wednesday when he was, what, 18?
Yeah.
Talent.
Going to be a
superstar. Watch him on the training ground at Gainsborough. Yeah. I used to say to Lewis, brilliant, well done. Game comes on a Saturday, first ball comes to whack. You go, Lewis, yeah. Why have you done that? 300 people. Sometimes it's mentality as well.
It's an attitude,
like I've said, for me, when I left home at 15, I was the quietest person in the world. When I got on a football pitch, like people say, it's not the same person.
Full of confidence.
It's so true. Lou was just crazy talented, wasn't it?
Mentality is, you go back over the years, and I go back to my time as a young boy. We signed 3 Scottish schoolboy internationals, 2 English international schoolboy internationals, but none of them made it.
Yeah.
None of them made it. And I'm thinking, well, they've got the talent, but what is it? And then lots of things over the years which you learn, you don't quite pick up, and we're beginning to get used to it now. We're understanding mental health and how to, and bringing people through in a right way, talking to them in the proper way. You know, I've seen so many good players. I read a book the other day. You know John Purdy? Do you know John? He played at Wolves. Yeah, yeah. Did you see the book that he wrote? He wrote a book called Herds, Booze and Birds. And at 15, he was the best player in England. Yeah. Went to Arsenal as a kid. Ended up being around the first team with all the boys in the drinking society.
Yeah.
And going down that wrong road. When I was 17, I got in the first team. First thing they said to me, you're out tomorrow night. I'm going, what? You're out tomorrow night? You come out. I went out with them. I woke up in the pictures on New Street. Never did it again.
Strong character that
never
is a
did it again.
To do that at 17.
Never did it again.
Peer pressure and expectation.
Never did that again. I went, whoa. You know, I woke up in the pictures because they took me out, and I went, I ain't doing this. So, but Purdy's book tells about how he, with the clan that were there,
easy
how at 17, 18 got into them, and the drink side of it became very important to him. And when I worked with him with Wolves for a very short time, didn't really get to know him well, but then he's written in the book all about the things he used to have, the Tuesday club or the Thursday club, and it's all drinking sessions. And I'm like, and I've read his book and I've spoken to him since and said, I wish you'd had a chat to me about that, even though I wasn't there very long. I'd have said, you've got talent.
It was the culture, though, Gaffer.
But it was the culture. So there are so many people. There are so many people who've fallen by the wayside with who've had talent. So, you know, we're going on to mentality on players. There's some things you should avoid, which a lot of younger players today are being involved because they learn from 12-year-old what's good for them. So they're being brought. So I think that's a good thing. That's one of the good things about the current football game, is that young players are being educated on what to eat, what not to drink, what to do, how to look after yourself. If you've got a problem, who to go to. And the clubs have got facilities for people to go to now. You know, there's all sorts of people around
Avoid
football clubs.
Herds, Boots and Birds.
It's actually quite a good book. But I didn't, looking at it going, Purds, what, you know, I didn't even realise the very short time I was at Wolves, that's what was going on.
It's not like coaching our Dave, is it?
It's not expected.
Because they don't really mix as such, but because the other side of it is they're together that much now. I mean, we used to see each other on a Saturday, and if we'd won, we'd say, see you Thursday sort of thing, because, you know, we'd get 3 days off. Have a rest, lads, go out.
Have a rest, that was the one.
Get out together on a Tuesday night. But
different
now,
type of exercise.
They're in the next day, you know, or even in the night time after the game, they're in.
The big clubs are there every day.
All the time, they're there all the time. The sports scientists who look after them every day, there's the register, they do it. So it's a million miles better, but...
I remember speaking to Troy Deeney.
When you talk about our era, or my era, the mentality would have been massive in terms of
the difference between the top boys
and going out. I mean, when I was a young player, some of the lads went out on a Thursday. They had a Thursday night out. You know, it was infamous inside the club until Saunders came to the club. Ron Saunders was brilliant at stopping all that. Yeah, so there's lots of things which have gone on over the years. But one of the things that we're noticing now with young players and players who are playing is how much the social media side can affect them, how the fans can affect
them. Yeah, damaging for them as well,
how damaging it can be.
And that's another reason, Gaffer, is it?
It can't be easy.
Is that another reason that they can't go out and do these things because they're in the spotlight so much that it makes it even more difficult for them?
But they can't. They wouldn't be able to do it. I still, to this day, go out and amongst the fans. I've got friends who will say to me, will you come into our pub on a Thursday night? And I'll say, yeah, and we'll have a Q&A. They'll end up spreading it around the area. I did one 2 weeks ago, just a meet and greet in a pub in Birmingham in Shard End. 200 people turned up. So the pub put food on. So they fed everybody.
Well, we got a cut of the bar, Gaffer.
No, we did it. I do it to promote just for the club. And we just end up doing a Q&A, having a laugh and a joke and go home. And I like doing things like that because I'm from an era where we used to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Brilliant.
But I was good at walking away from things like...
It's
strong character, yeah. Yeah, but it's...
You find that difficult, don't you, Sam? 8 pints. You're going to go home.
I know, yeah.
We'll have a few more, shall we?
Even when the bouncer told me to, I never walked away. So, after this few questions at the end, which players would you say were the most challenging to manage?
Challenging.
Stan Collymore must have been a difficult one.
I used to go around Stan's house... And I didn't know why I was going around his house. I just knew there was something wrong. And we talk about that all the time now. Mm-hmm. But I used to ring him and say, are you all right? Are you in? Yeah, I'm in. I'm just going to pop round. And I used to pop round and see him.
Amazing that, though.
Yeah, but we weren't aware of, like, mental health and all of that. I just knew. I'd watched this player at Liverpool with, you know, playing there, and I was thinking, God, he can't half play this lad. But I knew there was something wrong, and I don't know what it was. So, and Stan, to this day, always thanks me. And still sees me and gives me a massive hug. And I've done a couple of podcasts. He still does little things like that. I've gone round to his house and sat there talking to him. We end up having a good chat about things. We didn't realise, I don't know whether he would have realised. I used to just pop round as a manager, just thinking I've got to look after him. So he's really good with me about that sort of thing. But I never found Stan challenging. I think... Had I stayed at Aston Villa, I think he could have become something quite special. Rather than him and John and he would never get on in a month of Sundays.
No.
When I left and John come in, John was too fiery for that sort of thing. So I tried to sign. There was two people I was chasing at the time. Obviously, Andy Cole was number one. Stan was number two. And I kept getting told off Stretford that you're not getting Andy Cole. He's going to Man United. I wanted the Cole-York partnership. Which ended up being the best partnership. I tried with Paul Stretford that many times. I didn't, just get Andy to come and talk to us, please, please. No, he's going to Man United. And then we progressed to Stan and stuff like that. And I used to watch Stan play, and I was thinking, he's all right. So that's the next best thing for me. But we genuinely had a lot of conversations about having Andy Cole. We didn't miss out on too many. I tried to sign Les Ferdinand once and couldn't get him. Newcastle. Yeah. Just blew us out the park, really, with that, because we wanted Les, but couldn't get him. But it wasn't many people we missed out on, knowing our budgets and stuff like that.
So, in terms of like all of those players, Gaffo, out of them, like difficult to manage, but the best leaders.
So, well, leaders in a quiet way, Southgate, but he was great in the dressing room.
Yeah.
I mean, people wouldn't realise how funny he was off the pitch. Andy Townsend and Gareth Southgate in my dressing room were brilliant. Great, because they were at the root of everything. That, like, you know, Draper walks in and would absolutely hammer him for what he was wearing and stuff like that. They loved all that sort of thing. When I was at Darlington, I signed a lad called Mick Tate, who played for Portsmouth.
Proper, one of the hard as nails he is.
Mick Tate.
Old school.
Mick Tate was the best. If you went pound for pound of players I've signed, and I've signed hundreds of them, in 901, I think I'd done 902 games as a manager.
902
games in six leagues. But Mick Tate, pound for pound, Sam, you know him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm telling you. He walked. He's 5'9", 5'10", centre half. And Tatey was just the toughest.
Wouldn't have a scrap with him, would you?
Oh my word! He just was hard. He just was a hard lad, and I just played him in the middle of my two centre backs. It was coming at the end of his career, and we won the fourth division with Tatey coming into the team. He was brilliant, and I used to give him a can of Guinness on a Friday night because I knew he would take one with him if I didn't give him one. So I used to say, "We travel away, yeah, mate. If we stayed overnight,
it's good management.
Have a can of Guinness, son. Just one though. Just have one can of Guinness, because that was because he liked it, you know, and he was at the end of his career.
Yeah.
And so I used to give him a can of Guinness on an away trip. Here's me who goes against, but he wasn't going to have any more. But Tatey was pound for pound an incredible signing, because the effect he had on people around him. If you don't, honestly, he played something like 700 league games or something like that. Yeah. He had a ridiculous amount of football under his belt. And he was a Geordie lad, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Who was from probably Blyth or Wallsend or somewhere, was he? Mm-hmm. Probably, he lived up in Blyth when he came to us. In fact, he was manager of Blyth for a while. In fact, when we were with Gainsborough.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I think he was around about that time.
That's where I think I know the name from when you were saying it, yeah.
So Tatey was great. I look at Leicester and Agnew and Thompson. You remember Stevie Thompson? Do you know Stevie Thompson?
Yeah,
I signed him from.
I know Steve Agnew. It's Steve Agnew. He used to be my roommate.
Stevie Agnew, who's with Steve Bruce all the time now. Aggers was a good player.
Great lad.
I liked him. I always thought of all the players I'd dealt with, I knew he'd go into coaching. He used to ask me about things every day. So there's a few like that, but different clubs. Gareth, and again, people often, I get that question all the time. Did you know Gareth Southgate would be the manager of England? I'm going, no, I didn't. You can't tell.
He's an intelligent man.
Oh, I knew he would do well for himself. Yeah. I knew he'd do well for himself. But it's like the same as me, because I used to say, well, did you think I would ever be a football manager? And they'd go, well, I don't think so, when I saw you with long hair and the way you cut your fringe. Yeah. And I said, well, I used to just do that myself. So, because I have a fear of barbers or hairdressers or whatever you want to call them these days. But Southgate, I just knew he would do well for himself in whatever he chose to do, sort of thing. But Tate definitely.
Who was the absolute best player that you ever managed, like technically the one you'd look at and say, yeah.
I loved Yorkie. I really loved Dwight. I had so much time for Dwight, it was untrue. I used to try and sort of tell him things that I'd learnt myself about, you know, just because you played well this week doing something, the next person, that might be a strong point that what you're trying to play against. So find his weakness. I used to tell Dwight all the time, you know, there's no analysts or anything in the game or them days. We couldn't, half the time you'd never seen, Dwight would say, who's he? I don't know him. Where does he play? You know, what is he doing? Because we had like two A4 sheets of paper with a game, who played centre-half sort of thing. And, oh, good on his right-hand side. Da-da-da. Not a bad, not too quick. End of story. You didn't know them. You know, even at that era in the Premier League, you didn't really know everybody inside out. And I used to spend time with Dwight just saying, what I thought he should do and how he should look after himself and how he should do this and how he should approach the game and remembering the good things that he's done. If somebody's better than you because he's blocking that off, just do something different. Try and be different every time you play and learn to have lots of strength. But Dwight was definitely my favourite of all the players I've ever dealt with.
Was it because he was so well-rounded, Gaffer? Like he was brilliant at everything, wasn't he? So he could find a weakness and
he was a lovely lad. He was a lovely lad. He loved enjoying himself. I mean, he's typical sort of Trinidadian Tobagan lad. He just loves having a good time. But he was just a major talent. And Graham Taylor, who recognised that talent, hadn't found where his best position was. Ron Atkinson, who knew he was a talent, still never had him as his right. But what I realised was, the people ahead of him in the position he needed to play were blooming good players as well, you know. So you'd have been, prior to me going to Villa, you wouldn't have moved Dean Saunders. He was just like the top of the tree.
Yeah.
But it was an era where I could move the two players out because Dwight was really at his peak. But I just enjoyed being with Dwight. I enjoyed working with him. And that he sticks out a mile ahead of most of the people. People who were talented. Draper was a talent, but you couldn't teach Mark anything. You know, I mean, he's daft as a brush, isn't he? You know, I mean, he actually has said on a club official video that he was looking forward one day to perhaps playing for Barcelona in the Italian league. I swear to God.
God bless football for some of these lads, isn't it? Thank goodness for football.
He's actually said that on an official video, and then he laughs afterwards like, ah. It's like, so he was... Yeah, he had his own problems, which held him back. God bless him.
What we always do, Gaff, at the end, we always pick our, like, we've got all the guests to pick a five-a-side team. So for you, I think, we'll say, like, if your five-a-side team from players you've managed.
Oh, players I'm managed.
You have to pick a five-a-side team. So
you don't have to pick me and Sam, Gaffer. Don't worry.
I'm happy to go on the bench. Stick Yorkie in, I'll go on the bench.
I'm going to have to pick...
Who do you have in goal?
In goal. I've had to manage them, not play
You've
with
them. You've had to manage them, same.
Just manage them. So in goal, well, it has to be Bosnich,
easy,
definitely.
Yeah.
That's an easy one. I would say Gareth in a five-a-side. I can't put Paul in there because he just wouldn't
be five-a-side. He might not turn up.
I'd have to say
Gareth.
To
play with four.
Lost him at the services.
It's unfortunately going to be my Villa group, I think it has to be.
It's going to be. That was your most successful time. That's what you're best known for.
Yeah. But Leicester, I mean, I tell you who might scrape in there and might be a little surprise on my little five-a-side team is little Joachim.
Oh, yeah.
JJ
in a five-a-side, absolutely unbelievable. He's and I signed him at Villa anyway. Didn't play in the... But Julian Joachim was...
He's quick, really quick.
Stuck
electric.
Him on the bench for you, Gaffer, there.
Yeah.
So, you've got to have Yorkie, I think. So my team would... And I'd have Tails in there.
Ian Taylor?
Yeah.
Five-a-side?
Yeah, absolutely.
Flipping. I was with him in Northampton season.
Oh, but you, honestly...
I never won a five-a-side match in his whole time there.
No, I'd have Tails in there because I'd need somebody to do different work for different people. So, so where
he's
am I? Bosnich, I need what I've got Gareth.
You can have a he's done well again there, Taylor.
I would genuinely then say Draper, without a doubt.
Yeah, great. I bet he would have been good in a five-a-side.
Drapes was a good player. And I'd load the top line with Tommy Johnson because I love Tommy.
Tommy Johnson. On the bench,
well,
then,
Gaffer. Larry, though, Tommy, wasn't he, as well?
Tommy is, if you ask me who I've liked better than anybody else in football. Sorry,
like
Sam. Sorry, Gav. But Tommy Johnson is my all-time favourite person in the history of football.
Oh, wow.
He come in, I was at Newcastle as a kid. He come in... And I think, who would he have been playing for at the time? I can't
Derby.
Remember. Was probably Derby.
Notts County. Derby or Notts County.
They've done Newcastle like 1-0. And he's in there going, get in. He's a Geordie. He's going, get in, you Geordie. All that shouting, all that up and down the tunnel. Like, nearly caused a riot.
Yeah,
well, I was like 16 schoolboy going, oh my goodness.
Oh, well, Tommy's...
He's mouthy though, isn't he?
No.
Was he not?
No, he'd probably been out
maybe
somewhere.
Maybe I saw him on a bad
day.
Yeah,
I think so.
What were his traits in, Gaffer?
Quick.
As a person.
I tell you what, one-on-one with a goalkeeper, he's the best one-on-one finisher I've seen for a long time.
Wow.
Very rarely missed. He had this unbelievable way of left foot, power, dip and, you know, the dip and bounce in, like, and the keepers are like, it was one-on-ones, brilliant finisher, one-on-one, workaholic, good lad. I just like, Tommy was great for me. I didn't want to let Tommy go, but I got a call again, very late at night off the Celtic manager, and I knew that was the day I had to let him go because he wasn't a regular in my team, but he was a great person. He'd be the first one running on the pitch to congratulate anybody who scored, congratulate the lads in the dressing room afterward. Never had a day where, even if he was out the team, that he wasn't grateful at being there and being part of it, and he was brilliant like that. All the lads loved him. We had that Gary Charles, Draper, Taylor and Tommy Johnson, the four of them, with the heartbeat of the club the 3 years I were there. They were brilliant.
Ian Taylor's a great character.
If you ask him about Tommy, he'll tell you Tommy is great. They were the heartbeat of the club.
Some team that, isn't it? Some five-a-side team.
What's the team?
So we've got Bosnich in goal.
Decent.
We've got Southgate. I don't know whether you've wanted to go two midfield or two strikers, Gaffer, but I'll put Ian Taylor.
Tails can do it. Anything can do. A bit of it.
Right, so Taylor in there and then up front, York and Johnson.
Yeah.
Draper and Joachim on a bench.
Yeah, anything like that. That'll
some do. Team, that.
Not a bad team, that Gaffer.
Wow.
Just quickly, because as a side note, obviously, the Gaffer was, obviously, we called him Gaffer because he was in charge of us at Gainsborough, only Gav. And we used to travel in, me and Gav used to travel in with you, didn't we? We used to have Gavin Ward, and we used to drive over to the Gaffers, didn't we? And then the Gaffer would drive up there.
And Gavin Wall was always late, wasn't he?
Yes.
And he used to, me and Gavin hated being late. We hated being late for you. And we'd get there and I'd be going, Gaffer, it's not our fault. Every single time, he was so annoying.
I can't believe I waited for him.
I know, I can't believe
it. I think you said that you were going to leave a couple of times. We used to sweat, didn't we? Oh, proper sweat.
I didn't want to let you down, Gav. I do it. And me and Gav were in the back, weren't we? Being a nightmare, weren't we, on the way up there? But every time Gav fell asleep, I used to like, you were sleeping. When I used to fall asleep because I'd work, I was like trying to be a teacher.
I was trying to study.
And I'd be like, oh, I was far falling asleep. And he used to push my head against the window to wake me up. And that.
And then I remember I pushed Sam's head against the window. Gav was like, Gavin, just leave him alone now.
But the one time.
We had a Citroën. We had the Citroën, the chariot. The seven-seater, we used to call it the chariot.
It was good, that. I remember the time, it was brilliant travelling with the gaffer, but one time, what's brilliant travelling with the gaffer is when things are going well. But can you remember when Gav got sent off for having a fight with his own sent-off?
No.
Luke Waterfall, and we lost the game.
Oh, Luke Waterfall.
We lost the game, I think 1-0 or 2-1. And we've come in the car, and Gav's been sent off, like, before half-time. And I was like, I'm at the shop. This is going to be a long journey back there, says Gav. I was like, what are you going to do? And he's like, I don't know how to play it. And I was like, mate, I don't think we're going to be stopping off for McDonald's today. And we got in the car and Gav didn't even speak, did he? So I was like, I was dying to see what happened. And Gav sat in the back and didn't say anything. You just turned around and you went, do not sit there and say nothing, Gavin. Do not sit there and say nothing.
I don't know what to say, Gav.
I was like,
what had happened?
One of the first games of this, was that very early?
I think it was early on.
But what had happened was, I'd broke my ankle, hadn't I? Yeah. So I'd come back and, like, we were trying to get me back early. And I kept saying, Gaffer, I'm ready.
I wasn't trying to get him back early.
I was a captain, don't worry. I was a captain. And we're trying to get me back early, just trying to get us ready for that game. Because it was against Boston, wasn't it? It was like a local derby.
I can't remember.
And then, yeah, I think, did I score? Did I score early?
No.
I think I scored a worldie. But I think the first 20 minutes, we were all so pumped and right up for it. And I was like, come back from this broken ankle. And I was absolutely buzzed. I couldn't wait. And then I think I scored and we went 1-0 up. And everything was going brilliant after 20 minutes. And then we conceded and it was just started to go downhill from there. And then we conceded again. And me and Luke Waterfall just started arguing. And then the closer I got to him, he got closer to me.
This is the centre-half partner.
Yeah, he's a great lad. We used to laugh because he used to have England tattooed across the back, but he looks really Russian. So we used to say to him, like,
he's called Igor.
I am England. Like, he used to call him Igor. But he's a brilliant, amazing lad. And like, he was young at the time. It was all my fault completely. Yeah, and we just went nose to nose and I got sent off, didn't I? And I think he got booked. I got sent off. And yeah, the gaffer's like, don't not talk. I'm not angry, just disappointed.
That was the worst. That was the worst. Because you said that to him, and he's like, and Gav was like, I don't know what to say. And you didn't. Like, I thought you were going to go mental at him on the way. But I was like, turn the radio off. Let's listen to this. Like, I'm ready for this.
Gaffer, that you went all quiet on me before, was came in at half time, and we were 1-0 down, and I was like, linesman, flip this offside. And there was, do you remember big Leon Hibbert?
Yeah.
Big lad, wasn't he? And he's like, he came and like, I think you'd signed him, and he was going to literally, you know, tear the league apart. And he didn't really do a lot. And he wasn't playing. He was turning up late for training. Yeah. And as we come in, I was like, blatantly offside for the goal. I'm absolutely fuming about that. And he just went, wasn't offside. And I've gone, what? Like, out of nowhere. I'm like, who's talking to you? You're not even changed. Go and sit back in the corner. And he was like, wasn't offside. I was like, what's he got to do? And I've like, and then all of a sudden I've gone for him and he's like shouting his mouth and then we're all going in and then we all sort of sat down and like waited and the gaffer had walked out the changing room. Just go, I'll leave you to it, lads. We sat there half time going, is the gaffer coming back or not? And then
I'm used to Bosnich and York. I can't be bothered listening to these two nuggets having an argument.
And then you didn't come back in. I think we won the game 3-1 and then afterwards you went, well done, lads, and then walked out and I was just getting in the car thinking, oh,
good memories out of the gap.
I remember Leon, now that you mentioned his name. Just the problem with that, then the non-league scene then was like you're trying to bring people in from a distance and they were late. Yeah.
It killed him, didn't it, Leon, to be fair?
Travelling was a nightmare.
It was.
Being a younger lad then, Gaffer, I had no sympathy for that at all. I was like, he's late every week, Gaffer. He's taking a mick out. And then obviously he'd just gone, I don't think he was offside. It was like the worst time he could have said it. But yeah, I think that was another time I disappointed you, Gaffer.
Yeah, that, but then...
I've got too many to mention now. We haven't got long enough.
No. I think that's something that, like when Sam asked the question about, you know, the non-league scene. I mean, that was the thing. Like, you'd be thinking all day about what you're going to do at training, and then you get three phone calls saying three of the lads aren't turning up, and you can't do this and you can't do that. The principle of it was nice, because Swanee wanted to build a new ground, wanted to build a community thing, and that was something that interested me, trying to, but that never got off the ground either, didn't it? So there was all that. And then, but I always knew he'd go into the Football League, Peter. And he, well, he went in, but they've come out. He went to Scunthorpe and did well for 2 years. But he still rings me every now and again now, Swanee. But he has until recently, because he's now stepped down as chairman, hasn't he?
At Scunthorpe. I didn't know.
But he's often rang me just to check in.
Because he was brilliant to us, wasn't he? I mean,
he was good. He was so good. Yeah, the family were really good. Had a lot of good ideas, which attracted me to doing something different, but it never materialised. I mean, I remember we even had Brian Robson there, who was part of who spoke for a company that built new grounds and things like that. But then again, so we went through them sort of things behind the scenes that I knew was going on. You probably didn't know that was going on, about building a new ground and creating a community spirit and everything. But it just, so that's what attracted me, but it was never going to happen.
Not
so,
your bag, that. So, better off doing what you're doing now.
Yeah,
So tell us what you're doing now, just before we go on.
But basically, when Villa was sold, or trying to be sold from Randy Lerner, a fella called Steve Hollis was given the opportunity to try and find a buyer. So Steve knew nothing about football. One or two people had recommended him speaking to me just to give him some rundown on the club. Met him once and he said, I need you to help me. So I ended up going there as an advisor at that time to Steve Hollis, who then sold the club. Dr. Tony came in. So I was kept on in a position with Keith Wyness, who took the chief executive, and Keith and I got on quite well. And whatever I did was always informal. It wasn't like a formal role. It was very informal. And then it's developed into the ambassadorial side of things. You know, I mean, Christian and his people now are just very, very professional. They don't need, they know what they want. The managers know exactly what they want. The technical directors know exactly what they want. So basically, Ian Taylor and myself do most of the ambassadorial stuff, which, is meet and greets. Our owners can't come to a lot of the games, so we represent the club in the boardroom. But we do lots of other things. I do loads of work with the foundation. This week we've got some... I do lots of charity stuff. This week we're doing some charity work for Chris Nicol with his dementia and all that. I do
fantastic.
Dementia games in the summer. So I do lots of stuff for the foundation, which is great for the community work. And then I do my own stuff. I like to go out and do Q&As with people and things like that, which is just a night out. And I spend quite a bit of time at home at the moment, which I like, obviously. But I do keep myself busy just being out and about promoting the club as much as I can.
Amazing, Gaffer.
From our point of view, class act, Gaffer. Being a class act.
Always.
Thank you so much for your time tonight.
No matter how many times me and Sam have disappointed you, Gaffer.
No matter how many times
you
sub me.
Never cease to amaze us.
I don't hold it against you.
Well, I have to say, before I came, this is probably the most nervous I've ever been in my life, Sam, thinking of you two boys. And how Dave has linked up to you two.
He's really won the lottery, Dave. He can't believe it. Look, he's like, I'm best mates with Sam and Gav now. He loves it.
We went for Ryan Lowe, but Dave wouldn't let it go.
902 games, isn't it? Six leagues.
Yeah, six leagues.
But more important, you always
fascinating.
And Gaffer, amazing. Which is the most important.
What an amazing person. My personal role model.
Any questions from anybody? We've got a few people here watching. Anybody got anything to say? No, thank you very much. Go on, Danny, what is it?
No, just thanks for coming to the show, and Brian, it's really...
Oh, it's a pleasure. No, I've enjoyed it. I mean, I've been meaning to do it for some time. I know Gav's chased me a few times, but...
Said you were a nightmare getting back.
Yeah. No, I think it was the other way around, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, we are so lucky to have you here, Gaffer. I mean, I know, it's out of your way, but Budgie Motors as well, putting us up, not only sponsoring us, but giving us this facility for the evening. We're really, really lucky, and we loved every minute of it. Thanks, Gaffer.
It's a pleasure.
What do our little... What need to follow... What is it? I've forgotten about it.
So we're at In The Stiffs on social media and inthestiffs@gmail.com if you want to email us.
Well done, lads.
Yeah, cheers.
Thanks, guys.
Brian.
Cheers. Thanks a lot. Cheers. Thank you. Very good. Thank you, boys.
In The Stiffs with Budgie Motors. Budgie Motors are on Stafford Park in Telford and Featherbed Lane in Shrewsbury. For all your car needs, contact Budgie now.